This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twerk.
Yeah, I do a little everything.
Ian really wants to get bleeped.
Not around here, he does.
Not sure they've got names for you.
It's my age, what can I say?
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And the usual cast of characters, Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, Tom Ray, and special guest, Ian Oakland.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm your host for the show. And along with us today, we have our usual cadre of co-hosts. First, let's bring on stage Mr. Chris Tobin from Manhattan. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine. It's another wonderful day in New York City.
Haven't talked to you in more than a week now. We had to pre-record last week's show, so glad to be back with you.
Did you enjoy your time in Fiji?
I did, actually. We'll talk a little bit about that sometime during the show. Chris Tobin is a member of the CBS Radio Broadcast Engineering staff.
Yes, 6 radio stations in New York City. My job as technologist is to find technologies that help make us generate revenue.
Revenue sounds good. I'm sure the general manager appreciates that.
He's proud of the fact that he can't adjust the time on his VCR. How he always opens the conversation.
Well, to help people with the time on their VCR, the ninjaneer himself, Chris Tarr. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. How are you?
We're lovely. How are you today?
Oh, not too bad.
Yeah, how's things in the cold north frozen place you live?
Oh, I got to plunge a urinal of the day at work. That's been my day. My parents are so proud.
I know. It's part of the broadcast duties, isn't it? Oh.
Yeah, I do a little everything.
Oh, and the guy with the plunger himself, Thomas Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. How you doing today?
I'm good. Tom Ray from Buckley Broadcasting in New York.
And WOR, it's a wonderful place.
And appreciate you being along here. We've got some interesting topics to talk about today. And first, listeners, let me tell you what the show is. This Week in Radio Tech is the show where we talk about audio and radio broadcast technology. And that is everything from the tip of the stylus on the record, if you're still playing those. You know, that thing that goes,
familiar with those.
Things that goes in the groove on the vinyl. We really should talk about those one day.
Oh, those large CDs? Anyway, yeah.
We talk about the computer technology that makes all this stuff work. We talk about analog and digital audio circuitry and how all that stuff works, audio processing, and even some transmission from time to time. And also with us on the show, just in time, Ian Oakland. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Kirk. How are you?
I'm great. Where are you today, Ian? What's your normal domicile?
Normal domicile is just outside Birmingham in the UK.
Oh, okay.
So middle of the country where the snow hasn't quite come back yet.
So do you normally get snow there?
It's been bad for the last couple of weeks. It sort of hit the news, and there's been a universal brouhaha in the UK over the snow and all sorts of problems with that. It's gone away at the moment, but it's threatening to come back at the moment. So it's just slightly unusual for us to have it quite this bad.
Ian, for those of you who don't know Ian, and that's probably 99% of our audience, Ian is a audio processing expert, and he's also an expert at broadcast studios and outfitting them. Ian, I've known you as a person who sells broadcast equipment and consults broadcast stations, but you've also done some engineering, haven't you?
Yeah, it's mainly, I'm not really a screwdriver and soldering iron sort of person. I can't be trusted with that sort of stuff, but engineering, music balancing, recording, outside broadcasts, much of that sort of stuff, do a lot of that.
Okay, well, good. Well, we're glad to have you along, and please, Ian, feel welcome to just chime right in on any issue you want to or bring up your own. We've got a couple of things that we'd like to chat about on this show. And one of those, Tom Ray brought up, and this has to do more with U.S. broadcasting. It's plans for a nationwide EAS test.
Yes.
And Tom, maybe you can tell us what that means.
Well, at least since the EAS has been in place, which is about, oh, gosh, this has to be at least 10 years, if not 14 years now, we've done monthly tests. We've done weekly tests. We have yet to have a national test. Matter of fact, I don't even think we had one with the emergency broadcast system when it was EBS. As you know or you may not know, the idea of EAS, in addition to being a local thing, to alert you to any problems locally, is to allow the president to address the nation in the event of a national emergency. And we've never tested it from one end to the other.
Okay.
And I just think it's rather interesting. But I saw an interesting headline today. They tried it in Alaska, and it worked out really well. So now they want to do a nationwide test, which I'm all for. But they also said, you know, maybe the commission's actually thinking, you know, maybe we'll drop doing the monthly test. And there's no more monthly test. We'll just do a national test once a year.
Huh. Hmm.
And it's like, wait a minute. There are certain pathways in from the White House. And that's the idea of the monthly test. You test that pathway from the point of where it would come in all the way through.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're only going to test it once a year, now what?
Boy, that... Are there other things in your lives that you test once a year and they work?
No.
No, nothing comes to mind at all.
Yeah, that... I sure wish there was a great way to test... the EAS, the emergency alert system, offline, and
that'd be a good thing. But you know, you need to test it online because that's where people hear it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we could, I guess that's a good
point.
Well,
the thing though is you still have the weekly tests, which are online.
Are they proposing doing away with the weekly tests?
No, just the monthly. But like for example, in New York City, we have 5 LP1 stations.
Yeah,
all of which who can originate, the Office of Emergency Management for New York City can originate. And, you know, the idea with the LP1s is that whether it comes out of the city or whether it comes out of one of us, all 5 of the LP1s will get that and relay it within a given amount of time, and that'll branch out to the rest of the city. Well, if you're not going to test the LP1 structure,
yeah,
how do you know it's going to work when the real message comes in?
Now, you mean the LP1 structure. Are the LP1s... how are they connected to, say, the White House?
There's the LP1 stands for local primary, and in New York City and many parts of the country, there are stations called PEPs, which are point of entry stations. And in the New York area, that happens to be WABC, and they have a direct connection to the White House. There's phone line, I believe. There's satellite. There's numerous ways for the White House or for the national EAS to get into them. And if it were a national emergency, it would go through them and then come to us. And there are plans to also get that signal into the Office of Emergency Management over at over in Brooklyn. So if for whatever reason something happened, God forbid, WABC was off the air, the message would come through City. I'm going to say City Hall, but it would come through OEM.
Okay.
Or the state of New York into OEM. So, you know, there are numerous pathways in and to do this, but the idea of the LP1 structure is to originate the message and get it out. Now, if you're not going to do the monthly test, you don't know if it's going to go from point A to point B to point C and where it's going to stop. If you just do the weekly test, okay, well, I did the test and the station's monitoring me, did or didn't get it, and big deal.
Just my own interest, we don't have this... arrangement in the United Kingdom. As far as I know, we don't have this arrangement in Europe. Is this a requirement of holding your broadcast license, or how does it actually work? Are you required to broadcast this?
We are actually required to monitor it. The broadcast of it is voluntary, but it's a public service, is what it is. So right. We all decide to do it. But we do have to monitor because in the event of a national emergency, if you are not a participating station, you would be required to sign off.
Okay, so you either have to retransmit the message or you have to sign off.
That's correct.
And no matter who you are, you have to monitor for the message.
Yes.
Okay. Chris Tobin, were you going to say something?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
Thank goodness it doesn't affect the license in a traditional way.
Yeah, it just affects the license in a pocketbook way because there are regulations requiring the monitoring and the transmission of tests and such, and there's also a paperwork burden that comes with that. And if something's out of place, well, the commission can come right down and slap a $5,000 fine on you and say, "Here you go, guys."
Lovely. And that monitoring requirement is in form of audio or a big red light comes on, or how does that work?
At radio stations, there is a there's a receiver and there's a decoder. What the EAS test is, Ian, there's a data stream that gets transmitted. Right. In addition to a message, if this were a real message, there'd be a voice message.
This data stream, this is the famous duck farts, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Whack, whack, whack.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like.
Okay.
And you're required to monitor a minimum of two sources. So, in our case, we have an AM station and we have an FM station that we monitor. We also monitor the National Weather Service. And very soon, as the city gets the line in, I'll have a direct feed from the Office of Emergency Management at WOR. But as a normal station, you have two sources you have to monitor, and if you want, you can monitor the National Weather Service, because, you know, you do get weather emergencies like tornadoes and, you know, tsunamis and whatever. And you have to log, when a test comes in once a week, a weekly test, all it is the duck farts that that Kirk said. And you have to log the fact, and your receiver, your decoder, actually spits out a piece of paper. It tells you that it was a weekly test, it was set up for these areas, blah, 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 blah. And you have to log this fact that it was a weekly test from so-and-so, and you got it. You are required, if you're a participating station, to transmit a weekly test.
Right.
And once a month, there's a monthly test, and you're required to retransmit the monthly test unless you originate it.
So you don't retransmit the weekly test. Each broadcaster originates that him or herself.
Not always. There are some stations you can set the box up numerous ways. One way is to have it. I'm staffed 24/7, so we have it in manual mode, so the guys can actually check, see what the message is. Do we need to relay it? Some stations, the guys that lock the door at night or on the weekend have their box set to automatic. And many times their box is set, so if a weekly test comes in, it will immediately transmit a weekly test as soon as that one's done.
Okay, so we will retransmit if you're not there. It needs to happen week on a week.
Well, you have to program it that way, but yes, you can do that. And that way you don't miss a test.
Doesn't the monthly test tend to cover a larger area, like perhaps an entire state?
It can cover an entire state. In the case of New York City, it covers the whole city because we are kind of like our own little state.
Yeah, you are.
You're in your own little world over there.
But that's how it works. And the idea of the monthly test is to actually test the entire daisy chain, because once you get a monthly, you have to relay it.
Now, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned these PEP stations, and I happen to be a little bit familiar with this. Well, it would have been a great time to have my buddy Watt Hairston on the show. Watt is part of the PPAC committee, and WSM Radio, which is licensed to Nashville. It's just about 4 or 5 miles from my office here. They're a PEP, a primary entry point. That's what that stands for, station. And there are, just reading this, how many there are. WSM is one. WWL in New Orleans is one. I think WLS Chicago is one. Tom, you mentioned WABC.
WABC, WTIC in Hartford, WBZ in Boston.
So all these.
KDKA, I believe, is one.
Yeah, okay. Chris Tarr, do you have a PEP station in your area?
We do not. We just have our LP1s and LP2s.
Okay. All right.
Well, somebody there would probably monitor WLS in that case. You're close.
Right. I believe it's the state educational radio network that does that.
Hmm. Okay. All right. But you're right. I've been to the WSM transmitter site and seen the gear. Well, also at WLS in Chicago, seen the gear that is tied to phone lines, and they have, I believe they have some kind of a partial T1. They may have ISDN, and they have a shortwave receiver to possibly bring in the president's message if that were necessary. I guess if I were a commercial broadcaster or a public broadcaster, if I were a broadcaster, and I guess I am, I'll have four radio stations, if the president wanted to be on the air and his message was being carried by the national news networks, which are delivered via satellite,
that's the way to do it.
For quality, I'd much rather carry it that way than carry it after it's been rebroadcast by four stations until it gets down to little old Cleveland, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what stations would do if they're manned? They would find another source of this audio, like ABC Network or CBS Radio Network, and put that on?
I would. How about you, Chris?
I would. Yeah, I think you have to remember this whole system started back when communication was pretty much through local television, local radio, nothing else. So as Kirk pointed out, the cascading or the relay of that signal from the president, from the White House, is circumvented now by satellite direct to home, internet, and other sorts of information. So broadcasters, I think, have to be proactive and say, hey, in the event of, we should look at our options. I know here at our facility, we've got access to three different satellites, DirecTV satellites, Dish Network, I mean, everything. So we could pick and choose. But, you know, someone farther out has no need for that. They may want to consider local cable television, who's probably getting it through satellite also.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, so that's the news story. The FCC is proposing this. They have a notice of proposed rulemaking to change the rules to give us a nationwide EAS test once a year. Oh, so,
sure, politics is driving that.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah.
It defies logic, therefore it's politics.
Could be. I assure you that the four stations that I own could get the president on the air without EAS involved.
Oh, you bet.
So, and I'm sure you guys could too.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Well, another quick note. I noticed that Broadcast Electronics, the company that makes Audio Vault and transmitters, and they have been their company has been sold to an outfit called First City Crestone.
Really? Yeah. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah,
I think that happened yesterday.
And I think the last couple of days, GE Capital, the original, I believe, partner owner of the percentage of the ownership, backed out, had to liquidate assets because of the tough times. So it was one of the companies they let go.
Yeah, indeed. That's what the story by Leslie Stimson in Radio World Online says. Leslie quotes, he referring to President and CEO of BE, Joseph Rourke, he said the GE Capital, the lead bank among BE's investors, was over-leveraged. And just before the holidays, they sold their debt position in BE to cash to First City Crestone. So all this is BE has a new private equity majority owner, and they've had a series of them over 15 years or so. It doesn't seem to have affected their day-to-day operations. They've been coming out with good transmitters for quite a number of years. The company is BE is 51 years old, and they stress that they're not going out of business. They're just getting a new equity partner.
Well, of course you say that when you get a new equity partner.
We're going down.
Mayday,
thank you for investing in our operation. By the way, we're failing.
He gets up, stands up the microphone.
We're screwed.
And then walks away.
Well, just call me Mr. Obvious.
I'll tell you, though, it's got to be tough, you know, when Knott's Hump moved in recently into Quincy. And, you know, so there's a big battle that was, you know, in Quincy of just BE and Harris, and now Nautel's in the fray, and a lot of people have, you know, crossed the street. So it's been kind of tough the last 6 months to a year for them, I'm sure.
Chris, tell me more about that. What presence does Nautel have now in Quincy, Illinois?
Oh, they opened up a whole new branch, if you will, out there, manufacturing transmitters.
Wow.
Interesting. You know, they opened up a shipping hub in Memphis, but they opened up an entire shop out in Quincy and have been kind of poaching people from Harris and BE. They don't like to say poaching. They've been walking over and, you know, accepting applications from their employees.
I wonder if they're on the same street. If I remember correctly, Harris and BE are pretty much across the street from each other.
Right. And, like John Bissett went over there. A few other people from BE have gone over there. And Harris as well.
Wait a minute. So, you mean that Chuck Kelly moved to Halifax, Nova Scotia for nothing?
If you ask him, it wouldn't be for nothing. He loves it there.
Yeah, he does. He does.
I don't think he's planning on coming back to Quincy.
He had to move the whole family. We'll have Chuck on another show. But, oh, gee. Well, okay. Well, just a bit in the news. Hey, let's move to the topic du jour, and that was suggested by Tom Ray, and it has to do with reduced budgets. And I mean, it seems like every year stations are cutting budgets more and more. Of course, I guess the economy and lack of advertising sales could have something to do with that.
Just a little.
So, Tom suggests we talk a bit about working smarter with reduced budgets. How do engineers and staffs get along when they're told they can't spend as much money this year as they did last year, but we have to stay on the air, the studios have to sound good. If we go off the air, it's got to be fixed right away. We still want backups. The streams have to sound good. The over-the-air signal has to sound good. We're still doing remotes. We're still doing news. What are some places that, I mean, it seems like we've trimmed and trimmed and trimmed for years now.
Well, you start out doing, like you said, working smarter. I'll use an example. I saw a bill come across my desk recently for something, an item we needed. That's great. That's fine. We usually buy this item by the case, which one of the guys did. He never bothered to ask what it would cost to ship it 20 miles away. The entire case of stuff was $8.
Yeah.
The shipping bill was $16.
Oh.
UPS ground. It was like, hello. This is twice what it costs. I mean, God, I'll drive over there. It'll be cheaper.
Well, that leads to, so where do you go from shipping it? Do you drive there on your way home?
Well, I mean. You could do that, but you have to take a look at things like this. Because immediately I get questioned, if it cost $8, why did you spend $16 to ship it when it's 20 miles away? Doesn't somebody live out there? And that's a valid question. When you're trying to trying to watch every dollar right now.
So I'm trying to do the math here. Let's see, 8 and 16, 24, right? $24 total. Well, what if you can buy it down the street in Manhattan for $18?
You'd still be saving a buck.
Yeah, you'd still be saving. I mean, if it's $24 for the product and the shipping, what if you can just walk down the street and buy the thing for a lot more than $8, but less than $24?
Yeah, you're still ahead of the game, and that's the kind of thinking a lot of a lot of management wants to see these days.
Okay, so do we have some other examples of looking at obvious things like that? These incidental costs. When I first started working at Telos, it was we would FedEx things all over the place. We have a very spread out workforce, and if the home office had to get a piece of paper to me, they'd pop in a FedEx envelope. I'd have it the next day, and it was $17, $18, $20 to get it to me out in the middle of Mississippi. We don't do that anymore. We consolidate shipments now.
Yeah. What got me thinking about this wasn't the $8 item.
Yeah.
I'm on a committee. I'm not going to say where, but I'm on a committee, and a note went out saying, "Hey guys, we ought to get together at NAB." I was the first one who shot a note back that said, "No budget, won't be there." Next, just about everybody on the committee sent the same note, and now what?
You know, we've gone from lean and mean to skinny and pissed over here, and it's. Honestly, though, it's stuff, a lot of this stuff is stuff we've been doing a long time. And it's even something as simple as, I went to all of our transmitter sites and unplugged unnecessary, like modulation monitors and AM noise monitors and, stuff that we don't, they're nice to look at when you walk in the door, but don't be running 24/7. So, it's even things like, where do you cut down on electrical costs? And, we've always been pretty, in a smaller market, we've always been pretty lean. But, now I'm really emphasizing, PM on the transmitters to get a little more time out of the tubes and, things like that. Every little cent, if you can compound that with several things, adds up to a good deal of money.
So, Mr. Tobin, what do you guys look at? What comes across your desk that seems like an obvious way to save some money?
No. Purchase order goes in. No. That's how it works.
I like that.
It's just, hey, we need to. No. Yeah, but you didn't hear me out. No. It's a new practice. I believe that's something they learn now.
Somebody's got a phone handy, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm just switching mine off. One moment, please, caller.
Actually, that's a good idea. So,
I'm going to turn mine off. It's beyond our control. Please stand by.
Maybe I should learn these things.
So, Ian, you're in the business of offering equipment to people. What are stations coming to you, and what are they saying? Are they all looking to say, look, I can't afford the usual this and so that I buy. Do you have something for half that price?
Yeah, people are making their money try and go further, make the equipment last longer. The business is still out there. You've just got to fight a lot harder for it. I'm also finding that stations are now doing group purchases of equipment. So you'll deliver to one station, that will then be farmed out to three other stations in the group or something like that. So they're saving on shipping costs, they're getting a bulk price on the equipment, and saving money that way. But you're absolutely right. The answer is no. Now, what's the question? is policy.
Let me ask you about these group purchases. That's kind of an interesting idea, and there are some broadcasters that they can be described as a top-down broadcaster. We had Gary Klein on the show a few episodes back, and Cumulus, you know, Gary really runs things engineering-wise and makes a lot of the decisions at the top. That doesn't mean he doesn't let his, you know, local engineers make some decisions, but he does a lot of things at the top, and I think he is able indeed to save Cumulus a lot of money because of deals that he and his colleagues will swing at the corporate level. And I'm sure Clear Channel has done some of this as well. Are you finding, Ian, groups in your part of the world that are doing this on top down? No, you will take this piece of equipment. And,
oh yeah, absolutely. Standardization is out there. There is a standard build of studios for certain of the radio groups. That is what goes in that room. Absolutely, that happens everywhere. Yes, very much so.
Do you ever hear back from some of the people who are receiving the equipment saying, gosh, Ian, I didn't want to install this. I wish I had a voice in deciding.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely so. One of the problems with the engineering profession is that they tend to have opinions.
No, that's not true.
You know, we could have made so much money had you bought us that box instead of that box. It's ruining the sound of our station. Come on, boys.
Sounds like my program director.
Yeah, let's blame the processor. It's the turn of the processor this month. So, but obviously you're getting economies of scale. It's easy to repair standard equipment that's out there. You can have a spare holding that can get swapped around the groups and shipped around when maintenance is needed. From a group perspective, there's a lot of sense in it.
I'll tell you what. While I was in Fiji, the facility that I went to is a government-owned radio station. It's actually it's owned by the government of Fiji and run for profit. And it's six radio stations, and they have about 17 studios there. They have a lot of people there. Labor's a bit cheaper in Fiji than it may be in the U.S. or in the U.K. But they hadn't improved anything in years. And what I was wondering is, I remember back when I started doing engineering and I was working for some stations in the late 70s, early 80s, and it just seems like a larger part of the station budget was spent on engineering in those days when every transmitter had tubes and we were replacing headphones and styli more often, on turntables and belts and cart machines. Oh my goodness, we just had to maintain cart machines and it just...
That was a great way to spend money.
Yeah, yeah. Aren't we really spending a lot less percentage-wise of a station's budget now on engineering than we ever have before?
I think absolutely are, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's almost the problem, though. And I was talking about this the other day. When I first started, we had a full-time IT consultant type thing and, all these other people. And as things kind of got, we got into my groove and we started using these people less and less, well, that money was still sitting in the budget and therefore got cut. And, same thing with some of the things when I first got there with saving some money, spending more time, fixing broken gear instead of replacing it, that sort of thing. Well, again, as I used less money than my predecessor, well, that money ended up just disappearing out of the budget. And, to the point now where, there isn't a lot left to cut. And, they go, well, you're getting by with a whole lot less, and we're still on the air. So, I guess we really don't need all that money. So it's kind of a double-edged sword sometimes.
Having said that, there's also the issue of it happened with the station last weekend that I'm associated with. I was finding out about last weekend. As often as not, if you reduce the maintenance, if you reduce the security, if you reduce the redundancy in a system, one day it will stop working. Then there's such a rush to actually get the station back on the air, to get the station sorted out, and suddenly the backup is not there anymore. And the station can throw their toys out of their pram as much as they like, and they will not get back on the air. We're slightly different in that we will tend to, rather than owning our own transmitters, certainly in the UK, the model is that there's a transmission provider or several transmission providers that actually provide that service and the station buy into that. It is one of the largest parts of their budget. or one of their largest spends of the year. So it's a very easily identifiable thing to cut back, to trim, to reduce that safety net, to do that. And every so often, it does stop working. Every so often, they fall off the air. They've got to identify that fact, or they've got to sort of be aware of that fact that, you know, suddenly there can be a problem with this.
How anybody else have comments along these lines?
I think this is Chris in New York. I think a lot of it has to do with the mindset of the business side of the industry and the folks coming up through the business, the accounting, those charged with the budgets. A lot of the technology at home has become so easy to implement. The attitude, the thinking is, well, why can't I do that at the office? What's the difference? And because I think in the last 20 years, we have allowed that part of the industry to become the dominant decision maker regardless. And as a result, you've got comptrollers, business managers, whatever, making decisions that you or I on the technical side would present to them and say, here's the case, here's the ROI, here are the costs, and here's why. And they would say, you're absolutely right. I can't give you $1,000, I can give you $990. Today, it's, I don't see a need for that, and we're not going to do it. And I'm noticing that more in many industries. And if you watch any of the financial news channels, you'll notice that a lot of companies make decisions in that way. You know, Ford just recently made some new decisions based on engineering to make money, and they're enjoying it. It's a funny thing. The CEO is an engineer. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And same as Mashita Electric Company in Japan, about 7 years ago, had a CEO that was all about the numbers and decimated the company for LCD displays and everything else.
Major problem.
Yeah.
Do you think that sometimes the engineer has been at fault with this in the past? I'm talking sort of several years in the past, that the engineer has held on to the knowledge, you know, don't you worry about this, I'll look after the engineering, it's too complicated for you to understand. So there is that lack of knowledge on the accounting side, on the bean counting side and everything like that. And do you think it's something we've caused ourselves?
Oh, I would definitely. I witnessed it as recent as today. Yes, we as engineering industry professionals have sort of fueled this thinking and nurtured
it. It's a black magic, don't you worry about it.
Exactly. And I know in my personal experience in my career, I've made it a point to educate the non-educated and have found I can get what I need and make things happen. But those who don't, there's that chasm and boom.
There's always that nobody knows what I do until I don't do it type of thing.
Yeah, I know.
But having said that, there's also a professional pride. You will not let the station fall off the air unless you can possibly help it. You will make do and mend. You will run down the road to find something to make the station work.
Right.
And I think some of the time that's taken advantage of.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely.
Oh, yeah, big time. In many cases, unfortunately.
So let's think about what are some of the consequences of cutting budgets to the point where you're, as Chris said, skinny and pissed. I guess there's two places that can suffer. One would be on-air reliability, delivering the signal to the listeners, and that's what we're, you know, if that doesn't happen, then nothing happens financially. And the other one is mistakes that are made on the air because of cutbacks that affect the talent in some way, or the I guess the generation of the programming. Maybe those two subjects kind of go hand in hand.
I think the first thing you see is the reduced maintenance. You know, for example, I've got, you know, in the meter bridge, I have light bulbs that are out and haven't had, you know, I mean, I have money to replace it, but you know, it's things like that that, you know, it's more of a staffing issue, I think, you know, because where we used to have five people, there's two. You know, stuff like that, those bulbs will be out, burned out for a couple of more days until I get around to changing them or whatever. But, you know, there are, you know, even things like faders for consoles. You know, I mean, we have some old Wheatstone consoles. And when they break, you know, one of our stations in our one of our markets got a new console. I had them ship me all the parts so I could reuse the faders and the buttons and things like that. So, I mean, that's where you're really first seeing the issues is not necessarily the on-the-air, off-the-air thing, but more of the routine maintenance sort of things. And, you know, we should have had new consoles 3 years ago. You know, the ones we have now are just kind of held together with duct tape and a prayer. And, you know, so I think kind of the side effect of that, unfortunately, is kind of a morale thing. You know, we have the announcers come into the studio, and there's a board that, you know, although it's very functional, doesn't look real good. You know, and probably, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of life left in it. But, you know, we got to continue to try to keep it running until it's completely dead. You know, and then at that point, we'll have to look at replacing it. But I really think that's the unintended consequence, is that, you know, we're spending so much time trying to cut things that things, you know, like a broken switch cover, you know, we'll see where we're at next month before I order a couple of those. It's not really important. I'd rather save my money in case something really important breaks, kind of thing. I see a lot more of that right now.
Tom?
With a station once. It was funny because they were trying to save money, and I think it was November. I said, you know, we had a Continental transmitter, and I said, I need to buy a set of low-level tubes. We're not talking a lot of money. You know, I needed both driver tubes. Nope, can't do it, can't spend it. Okay, that's, I'll give you till March. So January came, new budget season, and I said, I need to buy a set of driver tubes. Nope, can't do it. Nope, not going to spend it. And I just kind of let it slide off the radar. I knew we needed the tubes, but I let it slide off the radar. Mid-March, the general manager with the owner of the station came down to my office. How come we sound so bad? I said, told you I need to replace the driver tubes. Told you that in November. The owner looked at the general manager and goes, why don't you let him replace the driver tubes? I never, ever got questioned on tubes after that.
You know, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, at least with my employer, I mean, if it's something like that, obviously I have no problem getting that into the budget. You know, I have tubes. I have, you know, critical things is not a problem. It's always kind of the one-off. You know, and it's more of a juggling act of, do I want to spend my money on that this month, or is there something else a little higher up? You know, it's really kind of this, you spin the plates around. But, you know, I've never worried about, for example, you know, if I needed parts for transmitters or, you know, the critical things have always been covered. But it used to be where I could, you know, I'd have a stock of things. You know, I have like a stock of push buttons or a stock of, you know, this or that or the other thing. And I'm no longer doing that. You know, it's more like, okay, if I really need one, I'll order a couple of them. You know, instead of having 10, I'll have 3.
But you know, you're right. You tend to have a lot of balls in the air these days, and you have to say, okay, I want that ball. I got to hit that ball right now. Here's the amount of money I have, and here's what I have to hit. So you have to, you know, reprioritize. I mean, long time ago, it used to be, okay, we need it, we get it. Not anymore. It's if you need it and it's priority, you get it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the upside is, though, is I think we've been more creative. And I do have to say, I mean, the on-air product hasn't suffered for sure. I mean, there are some things that don't look pretty sometimes in the studio, but it all works. And, I think it has caused us to, you know, in the past, it was real easy to just order stuff. You know, I need 10 of those. I was order 15. And, you know, you do become a little more creative with your fixing. And you know, it's helped us become good stewards of the money more so than it used to be. But it does get, as you said, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, I know this microphone needs to be replaced, but, you know, there's something in the on-air studio that's a lot more critical, so I'm probably going to do that first. You know, where it used to be, I'd just buy it all. I go, okay, I'm going to do that first, and then the microphone we're going to do next month. And, you know, you really have to take a lot more ownership of the budgeting process with that.
And that's the key. Yeah. That's the key right there.
The engineers that are on this call, I would hasten to guess that Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, Tom Ray, Kirk Harnack all have a fairly similar sense of priorities. What can you duct tape, and what do you say, no, we got to have the original part here. I'm sorry it cost this much, but you got to have the right thing, otherwise this is not going to work right. We have all gone into radio stations that were fixed poorly and improperly and ended up wasting money for the owner instead of doing it right and in the long run having less expense because it was done in a proper fashion. So my question is, where do you get that sense? Because I know there are still engineers out there, maybe some listening to this podcast, who may not have that sense or not have that experience yet to be good judges of when can you use duct tape and baling twine and some paper clips.
Well, here's the first thing. I just want a quick touch, go back just a second and touch something you mentioned with, you know, when things really need to get done, they get done. And a lot of that has to do with the relationship you have with your general manager of the radio station or even, you know, higher up with presidents or whatever. you know, my supervisors know that when I come in and I say, this is going to be expensive, but we need it, there's no question that we need it. You know, I've built that trust with them, and that's come with being a good steward of the money, that, you know, they know that if I come in and ask for a substantial amount of money for something, that we really need it, that I have, you know, exhausted every other option. And I really have, I don't remember ever being turned down for a large expense like that. They know that if I say, yeah, we got to get this, there's no question we have to get that.
Well, you build that trust, now, that trust relationship.
Right, right. Now,
that's
under
crucial.
Your question.
That's crucial.
Right. And now, on your question now, I think, you know, a lot of, there are some engineers out there that do use a lot of duct tape. On the other hand, I have worked for a lot of owners who have hired me on a contract basis that pretty much ask for that. You know, they say, I want it done as cheaply and quickly as possible. I don't care if it's, you're making a mistake. And, you know, there's the story of the BE transmitter at one of my client stations that I said, you know, you need to pay me to come down for an hour or two and clean this place out because this transmitter is dirty and it's getting choked. And, well, you know, we really don't have the money to do that. Well, they paid me 3 months later my emergency fee to come down because they were off the air and I had to come clean the transmitter out. So, you know, I think a lot, most of us, especially if you have any sense at all, know that you don't want to come back and have to fix it later.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really don't see a lot of people using baling wire and duct tape unless they're put in a position. And I always say this to the people who hire me. You know, I explain that. It's like, listen, it's not going to last very long. I think you're making a bad decision, but if this is what you want, you're paying the bills.
And you know, sometimes it comes down to that trust thing, you know, we had mentioned before, but some people have an us versus them attitude when it comes to I have to do the job and it's management and I need to do the job, but management won't let me. You have to work as a team, and that's where the trust comes from. You know, if you're going to take the us versus them attitude, yeah, it's going to be us versus them. You're going to fight every time. I mean, whether you need to buy a 5-cent screw at the hardware store or whether you need a $4,000 tube for the transmitter. If you build that trust and work with them and show management that you're trying to, you're trying to save them a buck, you have their best interest and the station's best interest in mind. That relationship grows and you get a lot of trust and you get a lot more freedom to do, to do what you need to do. And in a way, that's a learning experience for both of you. And that's how you learn, you know, where to apply the duct tape and where to put the paper clips.
Well, a good example is with my boss, where I know this year I'm going to need to buy a tube. I'll say to him, listen, sometime this year I need to buy a tube. You look at your budget and your projections, your forecast, everything. You let me know what quarter would be the best to make that expense and make him part of the process. And, you know, that way, when the time comes, you know, it's already been agreed upon and it you know, he can put it best in his budget to make it work best for him. And as you said, it's a real team effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, that comes with experience, what you just said, because you've got to have some clue as to when that tube may reach the end of its life or when you're going to need to have a spare on hand. Right.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And you know, you kind of as time goes on, you know, those things. And, you know, what I'm talking about, too, but it's I already have the spare, but I know the spare is going to go in the service sometime this year. But again, you really have to be good at, you know, knowing your equipment, knowing, you know, the goals of the radio station, the goals of the owner. Like, you know, we had Mike on from Sturgeon Bay a few weeks ago from WLGE.
Yeah.
And there was a great example of, you know, we knew up front, you know, he would rather spend the money up front to build it and have less maintenance hassles down the road. And so that's how he planned it. So, you know, to build that trust, it's just talking, you know, to the person who's in charge and finding out what their goals are.
Mike says to Chris, you build this thing so I don't have to see you again.
Right. Chris, I love you, but I don't want to see you.
So Ian, how do you find the relationship between engineers and managers, owners there in the UK?
You know, it depends quite where you sit in the food chain, to be honest with you. There is a game played, or there's something that seems to happen quite often in the sort of the smaller stations in some of the groups. For example, we know that one of the radio stations, one of the groups get their budgets or get the station budgets on November the 1st. There is a frantic spending of money between November the 1st and November the 5th. When the bean counters spot that all this money is being spent all of a sudden, and no more is then to be spent for the next 3 months. And there's that balancing act and there's that game that the stations play, they know they've got to spend it. They know it's going to get taken away. So we spend it as quickly as we can. That doesn't do anybody any favors, obviously. Having said that, you move slightly further up in the food chain. There was some work that I was doing. There was a processor adjustment that I was doing for a customer earlier in the month, and gave them a fee for it, told them how much it was going to be, and they said, well, nobody minds if you put a bit more on that, and they actually gave me more than I asked for. So it very much depends where you sit in the food chain with these things.
So back to – I want to see if I can get a better sense of this question, because it's always interested me the difference between engineers who didn't gain the trust of the people they were working for and those who did. And a prime example that just that keeps coming back to my memory was when I was doing contract engineering full time. I was called by a client station who I hadn't heard from in a while, and they said, our transmitter's been off for a week now. Our only transmitter. Can you come
in? Yeah.
And
because it was an emergency.
So I went to look. It was an FM transmitter. It was like a Gates 5 kilowatt FM transmitter, like an FM 5 C. Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, and there's obviously a problem in the power supply. You know, you turn the thing on, the breaker would snap immediately. So. We were both looking at it, and I said, well, it took a while to call me. He said, well, I had another engineer come take a look at it. And he said, I had to replace the whole power supply. Well, of course, the power supply is not one unit. It's made up of a bunch of components, you know. Right. So I said, well, did he say what was wrong exactly? No, he said just I had to replace the whole power supply. I said, well, okay, let's take a closer look at it. So we used the good old divide and conquer technique that you have to use when you're troubleshooting something that you can't measure or hold on to because it's, you know, 10,000 volts. So, we disconnected the thing in the middle and turned the transmitter on and see if the breaker would trip or not. And it didn't. And so we'd hook up something else and then the breaker tripped. And, aha, well, here's something that's shorted out. Of course, you guys could probably guess it was a choke. A winding had shorted to the case, and the case, of course, was firmly bolted to the transmitter cabinet. And so it was shorting the whole high voltage out. So as
I thought you were just going to duct tape the breaker open.
Yeah, a broomstick. That works really good.
Broomstick, and you wedge it up in there. There,
standard practice.
So
worst case, you get a new transmitter.
We found a piece of like 6 or 8 kilovolt wood, and you know, put the choke up on the piece of wood and turn the transmitter on, and it ran okay. And I said, I forget the owner's name, and I said, we have got to buy a new choke, and it's probably going to be, you know, $800 or $1,000 from Harris, but that's what you need. He said, well, that's a whole lot cheaper than the whole power supply, isn't it? Yeah, you betcha.
Just a tad.
Yeah. So I gained his trust. I already had his trust, but I don't know, maybe I was too expensive for him. That's why he didn't call me first. But I had his trust, absolutely, at that point. And the other guy certainly did not. Now, frankly, I'd rather the other guy had fixed the problem to begin with. I had, you know, too much to do at that time in my life anyway. How do you help an engineer, or can you? I mean, does this happen? I mean, do people just, I guess they rise to their own level, but.
You know what it is, Kirk? I see this a lot, you know, with people. And in fact, some former employees of mine were like this. For some reason, a lot of engineers are wired to never accept or to never admit they don't know something. And, you know, I always tell people when I run into something I don't know, when it comes to engineering, you know, they'll say, blah, blah, blah. I'll go, instead of, you know, you find a lot of people who are kind of insecure and they'll go, oh, yeah, and try to bluff their way through it. You know, my favorite answer is, I don't know, but I'll find somebody smarter than me and find the answer out. Yep. You know, I do think that there's a lot of, and I don't know that it's specifically contract engineers or whatever, but I think it's the personality of, you know, engineers are kind of looked at as, you know, these guys who know everything. And I think sometimes we tend to believe the press. And, you know, you look at something and you go, okay, breaker trips. Oh, yeah, definitely the power supply. And you don't even really give it a lot of thought. And I think that comes with that personality sometimes where you're just afraid to kind of go, you know what, I really don't know what that is. And you're afraid that it's a sign of weakness, you know, that you're telling somebody that. And I always think it's just the opposite. You know, I'd much rather say, you know what, I don't know, but let me go get the answer and we'll figure this out. And I think that, you know, makes that relationship that much stronger than, you know, doing the whole, oh, I know exactly what it is, and then later on the person finding out that you didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do think there's a lot of engineers out there that have that rap. And, you know, I do know that in some of the times I've talked to, you know, other general managers about engineers, you know, that's kind of that can be a common thread.
You know, I had a friend call me yesterday. He was he had to figure out the voltage drop from the bottom of the tower up to the beacon. And for whatever reason, he pulled a blank. And he called me. He says, you know, how do I figure that out? I said, it's basic Ohm, real basic Ohm's law. I said, you know, the wire is a resistor, as you need to look up the resistance of the wire. I said, you know the wire size. Oh, yeah. I said, you know how much the thing draws for current. Yeah. I said, figure it out by Ohm's law. And he said, you know, he said, that makes a lot of sense. He says, I feel dumb. I said, why do you feel dumb? I said, when was the last time you had to do this? He says, I don't think I ever had to do it. I says, well, I said, the last time you had to do it was on paper. I said, and it was when you were in school. I said, you had a problem. I can guarantee you had a problem on voltage drop and wire. And he says, yeah, I think you're right. I said, don't feel bad. I says, you know, I've had to do this in the last couple of years. That's how I know, you know.
So what both of you are saying, Chris and Tom, is that some of the best words that you can say, not only to somebody else, but actually to yourself, is, I don't know.
That's sure. Correct.
Because if you're worth your salt, you're going to go find out then what it is you don't know. And now you've defined what it is you don't know.
You're going to find out, and you're going to learn.
At least be honest with these things.
You know, I didn't go to school for electronics. I had no formal education in this. I taught myself. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with wanting to know. And I think in some ways that it almost makes you, you know, sometimes better what you do, because, you know, I actually took the time to go find that out and seek that knowledge and spend the time learning that stuff. Same thing when I got my SBE certifications and all that other stuff. Instead of kind of deciding I'm going to go do this and hopefully learn something, it's something I really wanted to do and worked very hard to learn that. But it also, I think, I don't have any problem saying, you know what, I come from an IT background, this engineering stuff, you know, I've been doing it now 10 years, but back then, you know, I was mostly about computers, so I guess I didn't know any better than to say, you know what, I don't know. I really have no clue, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to find out. So I do. I think that there's a lot of people who are just afraid to say that, and you know, those words are great. And as long as, you know, you follow through and actually do find the answer and come back and provide the solution, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that.
Chris, not at all. Chris Tobin, did you have a comment?
No, I agree. I agree with Chris Tarr. The trick is when you tell somebody I don't know and you're looking to get the information, you have to be confident in how you handle yourself. Because I work with several folks who definitely do not ask. And when I task them with some stuff and I come back and find out it was done very poorly, I ask them, if you didn't know, why didn't you ask? And eventually I got out of one of them, well, I'm afraid that I, you know, will get reprimanded, lose my job, you know, something to that effect.
Oh.
And I said, well, you wouldn't if you present yourself with confidence, say, look, I know all about this. I know where we're going. It's just one portion I just can't seem to grasp. Does anyone have some information on it? That would get you farther than just, you know, hiding in the corner.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, it seems like some engineers really use the online forums to ask questions. Hey, I've run across this problem. What do you think it could be?
Sure. Well, I created that broadcastengineering.info, the virtual engineer, just for that.
Yeah.
You know, basically an online, hey, I've been through this. And I'll tell you what, I utilize that. If you work fortunate enough to work for a big company, you know, we have an internal mailing list with all the engineers. We're always doing that. Hey, I ran into this. Did you know, you know? And I know Barry has a couple of online. Barry Mishkin has some online resources like that with mailing lists. And you know, again, it's tough because you know, especially with those guys, you hate to kind of, you know, get out there and go, oh, people are going to think I don't know anything. But, you know, the only it's true and it's corny, but it's true. The only stupid question is the one you don't ask.
If you're afraid people then think you don't know anything, they probably already do think you don't.
Yeah, well, you know, or just wait till you know, you end up just completely destroying something in the transmitter plant and then everybody hears the story about how you did it. You know, I'd much rather ask before that happens. Yeah.
So, speaking of forums, a couple of good ones to go to. Chris Tarr, you mentioned yours, Broadcast Info. I'm sorry,
Jay. Broadcastengineering.info.
Broadcastengineering.info. And that's we have that in the show notes, actually.
Yep.
Another one is the various lists that are available at radiolists.net. So if you just take your browser to radiolists.net, you can sign up for things like the broadcast list, the tech assist list, and then there's another one that's been around a long time, and that's at broadcast.net. So point your browser at broadcast.net and sign up for things like radio-tech at broadcast.net. And if you want to get into an argument with somebody, just go to alternate frequency at radiolist.net. Subscribe to those. Ian, what kind of resources do folks have in the UK? Of course, they can join lists on the US as well, certainly. There are plenty of folks from non-US residents, who engineers, who are on lists here. What other things you have there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look at the list, people subscribe to the lists and go through that process. A lot of the stations work in larger groups, so there'll be multiple engineers across the groups. If engineer A hasn't experienced the problem, engineer B might well have done, as you were saying earlier. I think engineers in general tend to, they'd like to pass the information across. They'd like being helpful people. It is a team effort with these things, and everybody will come running to mend a station that's down for whatever reason. So there's a lot of group resources that are put behind it, as well as the lists.
Well, we're about at the end of the hour. Any of our guests, any of you guys have a tip of the week or a website or a money-saving tip this week, since that's kind of our subject?
No, I
we've divulged all already.
I'm spent.
I should have put better shoes in the car this morning before I set off to tweak a processor.
Okay.
All right. Well, the WR transmitter site, when I'm there, I keep half the lights in the building off unless I need them all on for some reason. You know, anything you can do to save a couple of bucks, you know.
You know, Tom, I must admit that really is a more romantic way to keep the transmitter out.
Oh, no, don't tell the wife about me and the transmitter, would you?
Oh, I get accused of coming home smelling like transmitters. So.
Do they smell?
Yeah, they do. They have that HV dust.
There is an electronic smell.
Yeah.
It depends on the programming at the time.
All right, then.
Well, all right. Well, folks can go to our website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and leave some comments either in the Speak Up forum or comments about this particular show in the comments section. And if you have some money-saving tips, things like that, you know who's full of tips? It's John Bissette. We really should have him as a guest on sometime.
Oh, he's a wealth of information.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. We've had on the show with us Tom Ray. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kirk. It's always a lot of fun.
Chris Tarr from Milwaukee.
It has been a pleasure.
And Chris Tobin from Manhattan.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for being here. And Ian Oakland, thank you for staying up late over in your part of the world where it's cold and dark.
Absolute pleasure. It was either you or Lethal Weapon 2 on the TV.
I don't know, man. I might have gone for
Lethal Weapon.
And it was a close run thing. What can I say, guys?
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.